finish the most recent topic, which is Pikuach Nefesh of Pets. Pikuach Nefesh of Pets. A month ago, we talked about different Gemaras that talked about pets, and specifically the laws of Mukta when it comes to animals on Shabbos. If you remember, we looked at that Gemara about the chicks on the bowls, and you keep the bowl down, and you can't use it while the chicks on top of it, etc. Then last time, which was a couple weeks ago, we talked about how the Gemara already talks about this case of the cage of the tarnagolas, the chicken with the cage. Can you take the nest and talk about the cage? So it says that we said in the end of the day, you're not allowed to take it because there was a dead bird on it. That was right, sort of skipping to the end there. Tosfos has said that. Tosfos asked, why is it, implicitly asked, why is it that the Gemara uses the example of a dead bird? What would be so terrible about a live bird? Meaning, why wouldn't it be a good enough reason to not touch it? Meaning, in other words, why is only a dead bird mukta?
Because that can't move by itself anymore. The other one could.
And therefore what?
So there's always the possibility that it could move away. But why? Yeah, I haven't followed it to the end.
So why is only a dead bird mukta? But the implication being the live bird would not be mukta. That's Tosafot's point, that the live bird is not mukta. That's what sheet number one of Tosafot is. What was the reason? If you remember, anyone remember? What was the reason why the bird wasn't mukta? Or what is mukta all about? This is all about what is or isn't useful for us on Shabbos. A spoon isn't mukta because I could use it. So when Shabbos starts, I'm not going to consider the spoons mukta because I'm using them. So they're not off limits. As opposed to a pen, what am I going to use a pen for? It's Shabbos. I can't write anything. So that's mukta. A computer, it's mukta because I'm not going to use it. Right? That's sort of like a very simplistic way to look at mukta. We can talk about mukta at different times. So the question is, what is the utility of the bird? If, like Tosfos is saying, only a dead bird is mukta because it's dead, and what are you going to do with a dead bird? So then what is the non-mukta quality, i.e. the utility, what is the use of a live bird that would make it okay and not mukta? Remember? Remember, what is the use of a live bird? No, already a month ago.
You can send it outside the table.
Yeah, right. Okay. Some people say that was on Shabbos. Right? That's what
really?
The Zemer is based on. Yonah Masa Bo Manoah. That's what it's all about. That's when he found rest on Shabbos. I don't know if he sent it out on Shabbos or he landed on Shabbos. I don't know. But the point is, says revealed to this is the third source, if you have it here. Efer Achai, the end of the first line. Why? Mishum Dechai Chazi L'shatek Bo Tinok. I remember what that meant. L'shatek Bo Tinok.
So a child would what?
L'shatek. What's L'shatek? You see a word in the word Shatek. Shtika. And what Shtika means? It has similar sounding letters to a word that you do know, which is sheket.
Yeah, but quiet?
It means the same thing. Shtika is to be quiet, silence. L'shatek bo tinuk. You can silence a child. Child crying, here, look at this chirping bird. Now be quiet. Right? Nowadays, we have other avenues to pursue besides birds. But says Tosfos, that is the utility of the bird, right? Kishe bocheh, that's the next line of Tosfos. Now, Tosfos then says, V'einira, I don't agree with that. But the first opinion in Tosfos, Rabbi Yosef, he thinks that the bird is useful on Shabbos, because at the very least you can use it to quiet a child. And quiet a child. Today my son was crying, and crying, and crying, and crying, and all their normal methods weren't working. We figured he was sick, we gave him Tylenol, he was fine. Right? So the bird used to be the children's Tylenol, right? That's what you do, the bird would chirp and whatever, distract the child. So Tosfos claims that a bird is not mukta because it's useful in that way. If, however, you look at the Shulchan Aruch, again, we did it a few weeks ago, just a review here. So what does the Shulchan Aruch say in the very next verse here? In Shin Ches, in 308, in the Shulchan Aruch, Aser l'taltel behema v'chayev of, you are not allowed to carry an animal. The afalpi chain, and even though that's true, you can't carry the animal. Mutar lechapos atzasal evnei afrochim kishyalu. You can nonetheless use some kind of other basket or bowl to put down on the ground to help the animal. If you remember a month ago, we saw this more about the animal that's stuck in the pit, right? What do you do for the animal that's stuck in the pit? Two options.
Give it a way out through this.
Put stuff down so that it can pick it up. The Gemara's examples then were, you know, blankets and pillows. Or you feed it in that spot until you can grab it with your hands. Right? So that's what the Shulchan Aruch is sort of based on. It's really based on the other Gemara that we talked about before. But you can do things to help the animal. You just can't touch the animal itself. Right? That's the big difference. Mukta is all about touching the thing itself. Touching a thing which touches the thing, that's called tilpum min hatzad, and it's okay. And for extenuating circumstances, we're very lenient about it. Fine. So that's what Shulchan Aruch says. Uva odam alav aslo tassel, you're not allowed to touch it while the animal is on the actual thing. Says the Mishavur, why can't you touch it? Why can't you touch the animal directly? Shehem bechlal mukta. They are within the category of mukta. What kind of mukta? Ke'etzim va'avanim. Like sticks and stones. We're not breaking any bones. We're just talking about that which is completely useless. Completely useless. I remember one time on Shabbos, I was walking home, and I guess one of my rebbeim was with me, and I was kicking a rock. I was like sixth grade, whatever. And the rebbe said, you know, rocks are completely useless. You shouldn't be kicking them. It's the first time I ever heard of such a thing. What's so bad about kicking a rock? Because it's useless, and on Shabbos, we're very deliberate with what we do. I was having fun with it, but in terms of what's considered useful, that's not considered a useful activity. So says the Mishavura, animals are to the same extent categorically prohibited. Now, that's not the same thing as a pen. A pen is not like Eitzim Ba'avanim. Well, it might be practically, but in terms of its category, it's a mukta category. A pen is what we call mukta machmas iser. It's off limits, it's mukta, because the only thing to do with it is to do something prohibited. That's not the same thing as Eitzim Ba'avanim. Because the pen is not useless. I can do something with the pen. I just can't do anything with it on Shabbos. A stone is completely useless. Just its character. Now you can make something out of it, but its character is useless. Right? It's defined as a useless item until you make it unuseless. Right? As opposed to a pen, which is defined as a useful item. Now, there are other instances where something's mukta, which is only mukta to the extent where
you can build with stones.
Only certain types of stones. You have to make them useful. In a very technical sense, not in a practical sense necessarily. But you're right, technically they're useful. But when it comes and stone and sticks also, but...
If you live in a country that's really like third world going on fourth world...
Oh, so that's an interesting question.
Any kind of stone is going to be useful.
Does the nature of mukta change? I think the Gemara talks about that. Does the nature of mukta change based on the place that you're living in?
The YouTube stuff that comes up on my feed are showing people.
Oh, those people. I know who you're talking about. There are people that actually did it, and there are all the other people that steal the videos and just put it on their own channel. But it makes take millions of views. People love watching that stuff.
Yes.
I like watching it on like 4x speed just to see what they do, and then I like exit up. Like, okay, I don't really care that much to see you hauling dirt for 5 minutes. Like, okay, I get it. You're taking dirt and you're making something. Just show me what you made. Right? I don't need you to walk back and forth.
That's
okay. It's pretty incredible. It is pretty incredible. I don't know what they do with all that stuff afterwards. But because they keep going and build something else. Where is this place?
Yes.
Anyway, it's always some kind of water involved.
Well,
and it always
Vietnam or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah. Looks like a pretty lush land wherever they are. Either way. So yes, things are always useful in some way. Anything can be useful. The question is, categorically, do we look at it as a useful item? So let's say, for instance, a hammer. A hammer is a useful item, and it can even be used for things that aren't mukta. But its designated purpose is something which is mukta, which is building. Right? A hammer is used for building. Now, you could use a hammer to crack open, you know, pistachio nuts or acorns or whatever. I don't know what other nuts, or walnuts. Nowadays, we get them in fancy bags that already have them edible.
Right.
But back in the day, you remember those days. I don't remember those days. You could buy things, and then you have to crack them open, and then you get, you know, the pleasure of benefiting from your hard work, right? So technically, you use a hammer for that. The question is, can you do that on Shabbos? So the truth is that a hammer without any purpose is mukta. That's called a kli shemalach dola ister. It's an item which is designated for a prohibited purpose. That doesn't mean that it's always mukta. That's considered mukta if all else being equal is considered mukta. But if you need that item, right, tzorach gufo or tzorach makomo, you can move that item, let's say it's on your bed. So you can move a hammer. You couldn't move a stone, even if it's on your bed. So this is where it gets complicated in terms of mukta. Now, you can move the stone in other ways. Maybe you can shake it off or something. But you couldn't pick up the stone and move it. The hammer, you can pick up and move it. I remember I was at a Rebbe's house once in a place called Neve Daniel. I don't know if people are familiar with it. Nice little town. Yeah, close to Sefer, yeah. And one time his son had picked up the wireless telephone and walked it across the room. And then abandoned it in the room, the middle of the room, for a different toy. So now the Rebbe's like, okay, what do I do with this phone, right? So he thought you can pick it up, and once you pick it up, you can put it wherever you want. I'm not 100% sure about that. It depends how you define mukta machmas iser, how you define a phone, whether or not it's considered that. But for a hammer, you for sure could do that. Because the hammer, you don't want it in the room. You don't want it in the middle of the floor. That's tzorach makoma. You need that space to walk through. So you could pick up that hammer and put it wherever you want. When it comes to a stone, you can't really do that. For a stone, because it's mukta mamish, so that you have to push away, you have to, you know, maybe hit it with something else, hit it with the side of your body, whatever, you can't pick it up. So here, the Mishnah says, when it comes to an animal, what category does an animal fall into? Hey, Michal, mukta ke'etzim v'avanim. It's not just the kind of mukta like a hammer. This is the most stringent type of mukta. It's the type of mukta you can't touch at all. The halokhazu, it can't be used for anything. At least a hammer, theoretically, you could use to open up a walnut. But an animal, what are you going to use an animal for? This is Mishnah Berurah's explanation, description of why it's mukta. Even if you're going to lose a lot of money, let's say the bird has gotten into your kitchen and now is rummaging through your cabinet. And when you ever have a squirrel in the house, yeah, so they could really make some damage.
Raccoon,
even worse. They could really damage, right? So the question is, well, what was it? It's Shabbos. I've got an animal in my kitchen. Can I do something about it? I don't know. So the easy answer for all of this is go get your non-Jewish friend and get him to take care of it.
What we did when we worked on Shabbos is we cooked up a hot dog and lined up the hot dog so it wouldn't go out the door.
Oh. That is next level thinking.
Did it like it? He ate his way out the door. We had to pretty good get him out. I mean,
brilliant.
Animal control comes out.
Right.
We had a bird that's not that easy to get out.
Birds are hard.
All right, you can't put the hot dog. Could you use a raw hot dog to line up so he would go out?
I think you probably could. It's edible. I think you probably could.
Why would the animal won't even want to cook? I mean, what is it? No,
that's true.
I don't know why.
Defrost it, yeah. I had a squirrel in my basement last year. People may remember the saga. It was stuck in the walls. We had to lure it out, like you're saying. We tried all these different things. We had this guy come in, and he was a little quirky.
Guy. Well,
yeah.
they
not the official guys. They charged thousands of dollars. Just
no,
crazy.
No. There's a guy up near White Lake. Or
individual. Not part of a company.
John,
yeah.
Guy.
Individual guys will do things. Yeah, individuals will charge a reasonable price. But, you know, animal control or whatever, they'll charge you up, you know. Anyways, this guy was trying all the tricks. We did peanut butter, we did traps, we did the whole thing. Nothing worked. Eventually, this thing got hungry. Realized that he couldn't take from any of the traps. I don't know if he outsmarted them or never found them. But he found the toilet. And he started drinking from the toilet. Luckily for us, he couldn't get out of the toilet because it was too slick. So eventually, I was shopping. No, I was shopping in Walmart, and Ricky calls me, and we hadn't gone down to the basement in a while because the squirrel is just roaming around there. And she calls me. She said, "I'm hearing voices like whimpering." And I said, "Go down there," and she says, "I think it might be in the toilet because the lid was closed, but she could see chew marks on the lid." And it was in there, so I said, take something heavy, put it on the lid, I'll call the guy, and he'll take it out. And that's what happened. even when I opened the lid, the thing was still far down. It was barely alive. But it was. And he took it. I don't know what he did. I don't care what he did with it. But basically, none of the stuff that he tried worked. The squirrel caught himself. Either way. So the question is, let's say the bird is in your kitchen and it could break all the stuff. So is a monetary concern enough of a concern that you can touch the animal? Even though that's afilu hachi, asr l'tafsam b'yadayim. You can try, but you can't do anything with your hands.
You can't even get to them with
your hands. That's true, too. Va'afilu imhu mikvar t'tu ein bo mishum chashas seda. Even if the animal there's no concern that the animal is going to be trapped or whatever. So then, even then, afilu hachi l'tlam b'yadayim asr mishum mukta. Yes, still asr mishum mukta. Elo yafrichanam yaleim. You have to sort of shoo it out somehow. This is also muktzah who afilu muktzah method, because moving muktzah is even problematic to save you money, at least to do so directly with your hand. Ad kan, the Mishnah Berurah. Then we saw, a few weeks ago, we saw from Rav Moshe. And remember this one, this was like a weird one. Rav Moshe was asked, can we pasken like Rav Yosef and Tosfos, who says, as we said before, you can use an animal, a live animal on Shabbos, especially a bird, to quiet down a child. If you look here in the first source in the back of the page, Rav Moshe Feinstein says in the Tshuva, the third line there, Kol ba'alei chayim havelei muktzah. All living creatures are muktzah. Afilu ba'osen shatinokas masachkin b'hen. Even the ones that the kids play with. That's what Rav Moshe says in big letters. And then it says in small letters, if you remember this whole saga, right? But it says in small letters in the Tshuva, the question is, who wrote it? Maybe it was him, maybe it was his children. Ela im came, heim yuchadim l'shashuim. And then in parentheses, what does it say? I don't know what that word is. Pei ayin.
Usual for toys, shashuim or toys.
Shashuim or toys. If the animal is used for your entertainment. Right? So it says, if the animal, is it? What?
Earmarked.
Earmarked for that. What does he say in parentheses? What's the next line? No? Anyone know what an ayin is when you transliterate Hebrew? In Yiddish transliterations, it's always the case. Anyone here have a Yiddish name? Transliterated name? So how do you spell it? Samech Tes?
Stisha.
What's the last letter?
Ayin.
Why is it an ayin?
That's the way my grandmother spelled it.
The origin of the country depends how you would spell it, but you're right that the default would be an ayin, because the ayin is the replacement of an E sound. An E is an ayin. So like my mother's name is Pesha. Oh, Peshi. But Pesha is with an ayin. Pei ayin. Pesha. So whenever you have an E sound, it's an ayin. So here also it's an E. So what is this word then? No, you're skipping the ayin again. Ayin is an E. No, E. It's the E sound. E ayin is an E sound. No, close. Pets.
Or
pets. 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 P-E-T-S. Pets. Rav Moshe is just spelling the word pets. So here it says, when is the only time that an animal is allowed? Not muktzah? When it's a pet. When it's something which is for your entertainment, for your own self-enjoyment. That's why you have a pet. Now, you might have other reasons for pets, but that's categorically why you have a pet, for your own self-enjoyment. This sounds like Rav Moshe is allowing a person to directly touch a pet. Right, that's a big deal. You know, for someone who says that animals are muktzah, he then says, well, the one exception is if it's your own pet. That's a huge exception. That's the main question everyone asks. So what about your pet? Now, there are some people that don't say this. As you can imagine, there are some that say, wait a second, the Shulchan Aruch said you can't touch animals ever. Well, Shulchan Aruch lived in the 16th century when people didn't really have pets like they have today. Right? So they say, and by the way, this is implicit in a Gemara too. I think we just learned this Gemara in Yevamos, in Ksuvos, that a person should not raise dogs in their house. The Gemara says that. It happens to say you shouldn't raise evil dogs in your house, but the implication is that dogs are evil. So there's like a tradition, I guess maybe you can say, that Jews don't like pests. Jews don't like dogs. You ever hear this? Especially yeshivish, the yeshivish community doesn't like dogs. And it comes from those Gemaras that talks about like dogs and they shouldn't be in your house or whatever. Obviously there are exceptions to that. But the point is that here Moshe is saying that if you have a dog, so then there is an allowance exception. Most, I don't know about most, I haven't done the calculus, but a lot of other posts can say, no, no exceptions. But when what Moshe could be picking up on is specifically, at least in America, there's a big difference in how people treat pests in America versus how people treat pests in Europe, or back in the times of the Shulchan Aruch, when Rabbi Yosef Karo is living in Svat, or when Tosos is living in France and Germany. It's a very different ballgame. The way that the dynamic between humans and animals is very different. So maybe when the Gemara said it was Mutzah, that's because those animals were not for you. Those animals weren't designated for your use, for your entertainment, your enjoyment. But here, nowadays in America, so then who's to say that a pet is looked at this in the same way? Pets are now designated as useful items. So that's why maybe Rav Moshe, looking at America, saw it differently. I remember hearing from Rav Moshe Weinberger, for those who know. Rav Moshe Weinberger said from his father that two or three things, I can't remember the third, so I think it might be two, that he was shocked by when he came to America, Rav Moshe Weinberger's father. He said, number one is the fact that people learned sitting down. I don't know why this is such a crazy thing, but he said in Europe, people learn standing up. In America, everyone sits down to learn. They attribute that to just lazy Americans, I guess. Or,
they have the furniture.
Furniture and wealth, whatever. Know-how, business, commerce, whatever. But so that's one thing. Another thing he said is that when he walked down the street, people were not wearing as much clothing as they were in Europe, but their pets always had clothing. The people, this is how Moshe Weinberger said, the people don't wear anything, and the pet is wearing a sweater. The dog is wearing a sweater. Right, so that's the one thing he was shocked by. What is this animal doing with clothing on? Right, there's a whole industry now with animal clothing, right?
It's an industry with everything.
Yeah, anything they can make money on. Anyways, so that's the sort of the difference, the contrast about where this heter from Rav Moshe might be coming from. Why does Rav Moshe come along and say that pets might be an exception? Well, because pets are different than all other orientations towards animals in halachic history. And he understood that. Okay. Another allowance that you can do for a pet. The Shulchan Aruch actually says, "Im achla karshinin harbe." If the animal ate a lot of, I don't remember what this is, some kind of food, fattening food or very heavy food, umitzta'eres, and the animal is in pain. So now we're getting into not just mukta, but we're getting into how does mukta apply to an animal in pain? So then, yachol laharitza b'chatzer, you are allowed to make the animal run around in the courtyard. So that the animal gets tired and heals himself. I don't exactly know how this works. But the point is that you are allowed to do this type of thing for the sake of the animal's pain. Why, says the Mishavura? Even though technically this is considered to be a malady that you are rectifying, right? You are healing the animal. Virfuas behemto. Ain adam bahol kol kach shiyavo l'shikuk samimanim. That when it comes to an animal, so a person is not as bahul, not as hasty to go and help the animal. Why is it you're not allowed to take medicine on Shabbos, all else being equal? Sometimes you can, if you need to, whatever, not for now. But all else being equal, you can't take medicine. Why? Because you're going to come to grind up the ingredients and make your own medicine. Now that's how they used to do it, obviously. They still do it like that today. We just don't do it, right? The pharmacists still do that. They still crunch and make medicines like that. We just, have streamlined the process so much that we don't have to do that ourselves anymore, right? They make it in pill form and then we just pick it up. But the point is, but the gezeira still applies because that technically is still because, but there are leniencies because of that, not for now. But when it comes to an animal, so a person is not going to be as hasty to say that, oh, because I'm helping the animal, therefore I'm going to come to grind the ingredients. So here it says in Mishabura, you are allowed to heal the animal because we're not as worried. V'hu adinim hi krova lemisa. And so too is the halakha, if the animal is close to death, machmazeh, da'az bevadai bahul, and in that case you'll certainly be hasty, afilu hachi mutter. Even in that case, we will allow you to heal the animal one way or another. Why? If we don't allow you to do something which is only rabbinic, you're going to come to do something which is biblical. Right? Let's say we say, you can't even do mukta for the sake of your animal. We're not even going to let you violate a rabbinic prohibition. So what are you going to do? You're not going to be able to hold yourself back. You're not going to be able to say, oh, you should watch my animal die. No, I got to do something. I'm going to call up my vet. Well, that's a biblical prohibition. So it says in Mishpura an interesting thought, which is we will allow you to do that which is rabbinically prohibited to prevent you from doing that which is inevitably going to happen and is biblically prohibited. It's a very interesting thought process. But then Mishpura says, Kadesh is, yeah, I guess, so that it wears down and that you'd be able to help it heal. Aval, says Mishabura, this is sort of the last note of Mishabura. Aval aser lasos bishvila shum melacha d'araisa od rabbanan. This is a bit of a difficult thing to translate, but or to explain. Says Mishabura, you are not allowed to do any melacha, any one of the 39 biblical prohibitions or categories, either if it's biblical or rabbinic. What is a rabbinic melacha? Most rabbinic things are, unless you come to do that, especially on Shabbos. So it could be that there are certain enactments that are rabbinic, but which are not unless you come to do something, but which are for the sake of creating a Shabbos atmosphere. So for instance, there's machlokas, why do we have muktzah? Why is there a construct of muktzah? So one reason is, as I said before, like by the pen. If we allow you to move the pen, we're worried you're going to come to write with the pen. If we allow you to move the hammer, we're worried you're going to come do work with the hammer, which would be a biblical prohibition. But some say that muktzah is not for the sake of just preventing biblical prohibitions, but it's actually also for the sake of creating a Shabbos atmosphere. We don't want you to be touching things that are useless. We want you to be more deliberative, reflective, introspective. We don't want you fidgeting with a bunch of other stuff. So for that, it's really not something that you're worried about you coming to do something else, which is biblical, but it's really about the rabbi saw a purpose in not doing this act unto itself. So for that, maybe we'll call that melacha d'rabbanan. I'm not 100% sure, though. V'afilu himisa, mesa, v'ayidei enu Yehudi, however, if you could get a non-Jew, so then, mutzalah asos kishubahem acholah. You can do whatever you want. At that point, if your animal is sick, just go call up, you know, I can't call with the phone, but go get the non-Jew and say, hey, can you come over? Animal's in trouble. I need your help. So, all the way from this report, what we find is, pikuach nefesh, for an animal, does not override any d'oraisa. You can't do any malacha. But, if your animal is in trouble, you can do whatever you want with a non-Jew. And this, by the way, means you don't have to hint to them or, you know, allude to a possible problem. You can say, can you help me, you know, feed my animal or take my animal to the vet? You can even say, can you drive my animal to the vet? That's itself only the Rabbanan, right? Why is it that we're not allowed to ask non-Jews to do things for us? Lest we come to do it ourselves, right? There's such a blasé attitude towards malacha, so then we're worried. I remember I was at a bar mitzvah with my yeshivish cousins, and they had a chumrah. I don't know if they would call it a chumrah. I would call it a chumrah. To not open plastic bottle caps on Shabbos. Right? Plastic bottle caps, you know, soda bottle, whatever. That's different from a metal bottle cap. A metal bottle cap is crimped onto the top. And therefore, when you unscrew it, you're creating that cap for the first time, which is potentially a malacha d'oraisa of machlokes patish. You're creating that thing, which is why when you have a metal cap, we don't really have metal caps nowadays anymore, except for some wine bottles. Kedem has one. I remember correctly, some like sparkling grape juices have it. But usually they're plastic or cork. So it's pretty rare nowadays to find a metal bottle, but it does happen. So if you have it, you have to make sure to open it before Shabbos, because you're not, the alternative to that is, anyone know what the alternative to that is? Let's say you forgot to open it before Shabbos. Anyone know?
Use something else.
Okay, alternative could be not using it. Yes, okay, good. For instance, this happens all the time. I have, there's only one alcohol that I like besides like regular wine or whatever, and it's something called, I'm forgetting it now. Walder's. Anyone remember Walder's coffee liqueur? Me and my wife love that. We have like one shot last Friday night. We happened to buy it in bulk when we first got here, and we ran out of it a couple months ago, so I thought we'll find it somewhere else. But it's really expensive. But the point is, that has a metal bottle cap, and we always forgot to open it before Shabbos. So what do you do? So as I mentioned before, if you were to open it, you'd be creating a cap. You'd be creating a receptacle, which is, in halakhic terminology, a real kli, right? It's a real thing. However, if you would take something and ruin the cap before you opened it, so then it wouldn't be a kli, it would be useless. So what we do, we stab it with a knife. Stab the cap with a knife before you open it, and then you're just, when you open it, it's not a kli, because you can't use it. It's got a hole in it. Who can use a receptacle with a hole? Not a kli. So that's how, another way you can get around it. The point is that my yeshivish cousin, it was really Ricky's yeshivish cousin, wouldn't open plastic, even plastic ones, right? We possibly, you can. But he wouldn't even open plastic ones, which, for better, it doesn't make any sense to me, because it's already a cap, and they jam those onto the top of the bottles, right? They're not formed onto the bottle, they're jammed on the bottle, in which case it was already a cap before it was put on the bottle. So I don't know what that's for better, but okay, fine. It could be because of the perforation that you're taking off, but that's just slicing off the top of the receptacle. What?
What did he drink? I'm waiting for the punchline.
You're waiting for the punchline. So he really wanted this Coke. So what did he do? He took the bottle, he walked over to the non-Jewish waiter, and he said, can you open this for me? So that makes no sense. Because if you hold that it's okay to do it, so then do it yourself. If you hold that it's not okay to do it, so then you can't have the non-Jew to do it.
Right.
So either way, it doesn't make any sense. So that's Amir Lenachri. You can't ask a non-Jew to do something for you, because we're worried that if you create this dynamic where, oh, we'll just get the non-Jew to do it, somebody's going to come along and say, oh, well, what's the difference between them doing it or we doing it? They're doing it for us either way, so let's just do it ourselves. We're worried about that. So that's why you can't ask a non-Jew. It says in the Shavrua that there are exceptions to that. There are exceptions. If in a time of need, let's say, for instance, the lights are off in the shul and we can't daven. So some would say that the shvus, the makom mitzvah, or in this case, the makom mitzvah and a tzorach rabim, it's allowing us to daven properly, and it is a public need. So then you'd be allowed to ask a non-Jew explicitly, hey, can you help us with the light?
Would you have been able to say, the non-Jew, the bottle's not open?
Yes, that would be a hinting. That would be potentially okay. This is a pun. That's a can of worms, because once you get into that arena, there are really actually two problems with asking a non-Jew to do something for you. Number one is how you say it, and number two is benefiting from whatever they did. So the question is really, are you benefiting from the opening of that bottle? There's a big machlokas haposkim as to, can you have a non-Jew bring a key from outside of the public domain, from outside of the private domain, meaning from the public domain into the private domain, which is a prohibition, a biblical prohibition, and then open the door for you. Let's say he does it. Let's say the non-Jew does it. He's not using that building. He's just doing it for the Jews. So you open the door now. Am I allowed to walk through that door? When we look at the act that the non-Jew did, do we look at it as if he has created an opening for us in a prohibited way? Or do we look at it as, well, he just moved that thing inside the door. I'm not benefiting from that thing that he moved. I'm benefiting from the product of that activity. So for instance, halakha l'maisa, that might not happen in your house. But this could happen. If the non-Jew comes and turns the light on for you, so then there's the question of whether you can stay in that room and benefit from that light. That's not an easy thing to answer. The real answer is you can only stay in that room if you could have already been in that room because there's a little bit of light beforehand. If it's mamish unusable, you can't be in that room. You can't do anything in that room. And he turns the light on, and he's not using that room himself. I don't know if there's an allowance for that, because then you're benefiting from a prohibition that was done by a non-Jew. That's an independent problem. If, however, the light was on, let's say in your bedroom, and you want to go to sleep, and you can hint without asking him to actually turn the light off, you're not saying, can you turn the light off, but you're saying, the light in my room is on.
This is what happens to Stella if Shabbos.
Okay.
The light that usually goes on at the timer never went off.
Okay. So if you go to the non-Jew and you say, the light is on, that's all you say, and then the non-Jew comes and figures it out and turns it off, so then are you benefiting from the act of the non-Jew? Think about it. Are you benefiting from the act of the non-Jew or from the prohibition of the non-Jew?
Yeah.
Says Tosfos, a huge chiddush. When it comes to turning the light on, so the non-Jew created a fire, and now you're benefiting from that fire. When he turns the light off, what are you benefiting from? You're benefiting from the lack of fire. The non-Jew didn't create the lack of fire. He just took away the fire. The lack of fire came when there was no more fire. But he didn't. There's no physical, tangible thing that he created that now you're using. So that's a big distinction in halakha. So in terms of hinting, hinting is only one stage of the process. Then there's the whether you can benefit from the act of knowledge. Two separate things. So here, says the Mishnah Berurah, when it comes to the pain of the animal, that all goes out the window. Forget about the hinting, and forget about benefiting from the act of a non-Jew. You can do whatever you want. I mean, this is a real heter, it's a real allowance. This is something which is typically usur, which is typically prohibited, and the Mishnah Berurah is saying you're allowed to do it. This is no small heter, no small allowance. You are absolutely allowed to ask a non-Jew explicitly, can you drive my animal to the veterinarian for me? Now, I don't know if you can get in the car. At that point, you're talking about things that maybe you should avoid doing. But you can ask a non-Jew explicitly to violate prohibitions, which if you did them would be prohibited biblically. Because asking a non-Jew to do them is only rabbinic. So that's Ad Kana as far as we've gotten. Here's the Shmir Shabbos Kilechusa. Very popular day for on Shabbos. Kamur le'el sifchaf hei ba'alei chayim mukta heim b'shabbos v'yom tov. Animals are mukta. Even though that's the case, yesh, there are some kinds of situations. Shemishum sar bali chayim hitiru chazal of talfel behema. That is a loaded question, a loaded statement. What did the Mishnah Berurah allow? The Mishnah Berurah allowed you to go talk to a non-Jew to do something for you. He never said that you can touch the animal yourself. He never said that. And that's the implication, if you remember from the Gemara a month ago. The implication being that when the animal is in the pit, what are you allowed to do? Not touch him, but put pillows down, give him food while he's in the pit, but you can't touch the animal. Says Shmuel Shabbos Pilchus, there are times that because of Tzar Ba'al Echaim, which if you remember, 5 weeks ago, when we introduced this topic, somebody brought up, that was the pain of the animal. So says Shmuel Shabbos Pilchus, yeah, you are allowed to move the animal sometimes if the animal is in pain. We're not talking about biblical prohibitions. It's only mukta, right? So it's only rabbinic. V'yesh l'sh'ol b'shabbos she'elat chacham l'kabel hora'os mefuratos ketad linong b'shat hamlat ha'shel behema v'chol mikra mikra. Says the Shmir Shabbos Kilchusa, every situation is different. Ask the rabbi when that comes up. Ask some kind of halachic authority what the best way to go about it. Maybe there are ways that you can avoid most tithurim or most, you can avoid mukta one way or another. Furthermore, he says, Ein osn letzarach refuasa shel behema kol melacha. You're not allowed to do any melacha. That's how the Mishnah Berurah said. When it comes to healing an animal, not saving an animal's life, but healing the animal, so you can't do any melacha. Afilim yesh barach mishemitzer drabanan. I think that's what that is. Ulam iser she'enu noveh mimlecha Shabbos bein iser Torah bein iser drabanan el shachazal asru la'asos v'gzer letzarach refuasa shel adam uchadu l'halim paraglam adal mutzer la'asos letzarach refuasa shel ba'alei chayim. You are allowed to violate gezeiras, right? Things that the rabbi said, don't do this unless you come to do that. Those things you can violate on Shabbos. V'lochei mutra lisiyam lebehema shrufos lahazrik lazirika toch shririt. V'tautel mukta b'shvila olasim mishcha al pitza ach yizar shalol limroach es ha-mishcha v'yizar v'chol zeh shalol l'tautel ha-sabehema. You can take foods which are particularly the mukta, right? So for instance, in the stealth case, when it comes to the hot dog, which is maybe mukta because it's frozen, although even that, I'm not sure if it is mukta. Something which is something that you would not eat, let's say dog food or something like that, you could handle that food, it's a separate problem, really, but for the sake of, you can go get food like that and carry it, even if it might be mukta because it's not yours or whatever. You can still do that for the sake of healing your dog. But you just can't move the dog with your hands. V'yeshli hiva eitz, b'mora hara'a, some people, you should seek out the wisdom or the counsel of a rabbi. Ma mutter ma asu lasos v'shil behema. I don't know if this Noach is part of it or not. Mutter lomer l'nachri, lasos afil yifturi Torah. But when it comes to asking a non-Jew, you can ask a non-Jew to do anything which is even biblically prohibited. Kishayesh chashash sakana lebehema. When there's a concern that the animal is going to die, the animal is in danger, you can ask the non-Jew to do anything for you. V'gam kasher hichola ve'ein sakana lechaya, and even if the animal is just sick, but not in danger of its life, afilu kishayesh l'rak tsar, even if there's just pain, so there's a certain leniency here, which is even more lenient in some ways than humans. If the animal is sick, you can ask a non-Jew to do whatever you need. Whereas if a person was sick, it depends how sick they are to violate a derabbanan. So while it's true you couldn't violate a biblical prohibition like you would for a person, You can violate the rabbinic prohibition of asking a non-Jew, and even in the case where there's pain and you don't know how painful it is, even in that case you can ask a non-Jew, which is potentially more than you could say for a human pain. Human pains have to, right, they cross a certain threshold of comfort or discomfort in order to violate a rabbinic prohibition. So in the end of the day, pikuach nefesh of pets, can you violate Shabbos? Not biblically. If your animal is in need, and there are no non-Jews around, unfortunately, you can't violate any biblical prohibitions to save the animal. But you can violate, this is a real violation, you can violate the prohibition to ask a non-Jew to do those things. So that is, there is a leniency, there is an allowance, a overruling of an actual prohibition for the sake of animals. So it's not like we're insensitive entirely. It's not like tough luck, let your dog die. We will allow you to violate the prohibition of asking a non-Jew, but we won't allow you to violate any biblical prohibitions for the animal. And in that way, you understand the distinction between a person and an animal. There are we have sensitivities towards animals, but not to the same level that we have sensitivities towards humans. I remember there was this big debate maybe 10 years ago or so. I think it was already debated, and then like Dennis Prager made it more of a big thing. There was a study done about people who were asked, if your dog and a random stranger you never met were both drowning, who would you save? It's an interesting question, right? Instinctively, a person might want to save their dog. Morally, however, that's reprehensible, to save a dog before a person. And so this was, and the study showed that I think it was a majority of people wanted to save the dog. Which, you know, when push comes to shove, you ask the person honestly, so that's what they probably say, because they don't care about other people. But it was sort of like an expression of the moral decay of society, whatever. So the point is, halachically, this keeps our priorities, you know, in line. For a human in danger, you can violate biblical prohibitions, no questions asked, even if you think it's only a possibility that their life is in danger, not even for sure. Even if it's a suffix, that kind of, you can violate biblical prohibitions. But an animal, no, that's where we draw the line.
To these commercials for
pets?
You know, save the dying animal today. They're starving, freezing, roasting, whatever.
Yeah.
And they use human pronouns.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Dog, who, and I'm thinking, what do you mean, who?
Right, right, right. Yeah, which. Yeah.
Or that.
Yeah, that.
Whatever. I mean.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, people are relating more and more to their animals as part of their families. In verbiage, I'm talking about, in verbiage. Yeah.
But
yeah,
verbiage
yeah.
is just mirroring what people are feeling.
Exactly. Yeah, you're right. You're right. It's not just a slip of colloquialism that
no,
they. That's
no.
really what they. That's how they see their animals. So it's obviously.
How they collecting
we
money.
Can,
if
we
they
have.
Make you feel as if
that's true too.
Person.
That's true. It could be a business play too. But that's how people really do. Really do relate to it. But the sensitivity to animals is a real thing. We allow you to violate prohibitions. It's not the same prohibitions that we allow for humans. Right. So that's the distinction. You see the. Sort of the sensitivities of halakha coming out very clearly at the end of the sugya, where for humans we have one level of concern, and for animals we have another. It's a level of concern. It's not like we, you know, just give luck, let things ride out and best of luck. We allow you to have concern for the animal and violate halakha, but not all halakha. So that's where it comes out, and it's a good sort of reminder for our sort of moral compass. That to what extent we will violate Shabbos for the sake of an animal. Okay, we'll have to come up with another topic. Probably I'll try to make it the last topic before we switch to the grander topic, but we'll see what I come up with. Okay.